I always have difficulty with microphones. My height creates problems. I had a great, great, great grandfather who was 6'8" and who got into a debate. He was a member of Congress before the Civil War from North Carolina, and he got into a debate with Douglas, of the Lincoln Douglas debates, who was quite short at 5'3" or 5'4", although he was quite cocky. And he gave my ancestor choice of both weapon and place after an argument they had had. And my ancestor said, okay, if that's the way you want to be about it, broadswords in the middle of the Potomac. And they got about three steps in, and he won by default. I do appreciate, I judge motels and hotels by the height of the shower head, and I congratulate the Federalist Society. This is an easy job for me to introduce this panel. I can't imagine that they really need any introduction, so I'm really not going to say much about them. I do want to make an announcement to begin with, though, which is that there's a press conference after this in room 272, immediately following, before the lunch. I have, as someone who is working in government, an ambivalence, obviously, about the First Amendment, having been slammed several times, probably with justification, but doesn't make you feel any better. So I'll keep my words to a minimum because there are press here. But I do have some questions, which I hope that you and the audience and the panelists will think about. Has Congress placed too many restrictions on the right of the public, the business community to be sure included, but others, to petition the government for redress of grievances, to speak out about problems that they have with government regulation, the kind of thing that I think Milton Friedman was talking about last night? The Congress really has tried, the courts have not gone along, but the Congress has tried to cut the lines of communication, speech, between the White House and the regulatory agencies. Judge Scalia knows something about this. Is that a restriction on speech, or is it a permissible regulation of the way government does business? Does the SEC have too many restrictions on the way people try to raise money for ventures? Do they assume too little knowledge and sophistication on the part of investors, or should they make any assumptions at all? What about the Federal Trade Commission? Jim Miller has done a lot to cut back on their regulation of false and misleading advertising. Is there any right to do any of that at all? And then the FCC will come in later to play, but it is interesting that the lifting of regulations on cable television made a lot of the religious broadcasting possible. I don't think Pat Robertson would be what he is today without cable television. Is libel law, is the way it works, a restriction on the right of people who've been allegedly hurt, as a restriction on their ability to speak back in the courts or elsewhere? The same way with the laws on pornography and the way the First Amendment works there. Is the First Amendment used, or is it a restriction on the right of a community to speak back against those who make money off of selling magazines? Is private access to government a restriction by the government on speech? Now, the Freedom of Information Act, for example, is sometimes used, really, as an industrial espionage statute, if you really look at it. Does the government have a right to hold classified information, and is that a restriction, or is that something which it must do for its own operations of international policy? Without going any further, and without getting in any further trouble, I want to introduce the panel. Judge Scalia is well known to all of you. Graham Rudman would never have been the same without you, Judge Scalia. Professor Epstein is a well-known, prolific author at the University of Chicago, author of a recent book on takings. Floyd Abrams is a well-known First Amendment lawyer representing New York Times and NBC, among many other clients, and he's argued many cases in the Supreme Court. And Professor Lino Graglia is a graduate of Columbia Law School, professor at the University of Texas. I think may have a few words to say about pornography. So without any further ado, Judge Scalia.
Thank you, Boyden. I've been told to speak no more than 10 minutes. It's very hard to speak no more than 10 minutes on a subject that is the First Amendment speech and press clauses, which I would begin by reminding you, read that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press. I want to share with you two peculiarities about judicial treatment of this particular provision of the Constitution that have always struck me. The first of which is the relative absence of resort to tradition in giving content to this provision of the law. Some provisions of the Constitution are, you might say, self-contained. When Article 1, Section 7 says you need two-thirds of the Congress to override a presidential veto, it means two-thirds of the Congress, and you don't have to resort to any historical analysis to understand what that means. And I suppose there are even a few provisions of the Bill of Rights, though only a few, that are self-contained in that sense. There's no need to resort to tradition when you come to interpreting the provision of the Sixth Amendment that says that all criminal prosecution shall be brought in the state and district where the crime was committed, or the provision of the Third Amendment that says that no soldier shall, in time of peace, be quartered in any house without the consent of the owner. Frankly, I have trouble thinking of any besides those two that fall into this this clear category. Most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights do, in fact, require some resort to what the understood practice of our society has been. The due process clause, for example. If you ask a 16th century Inca what due process of law consisted of, or for that matter, a 20th century Frenchman, you're going to get quite a different answer from what would have been provided by an 18th century American or a 20th century American. The provision is meaningless without reference to an understood tradition. And that is so, I think, with respect to most of the provisions of the Bill of Rights. What about the provision that Congress shall make no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press? Is it the clear and traditionless sort of provision, or is it something like the Due Process Clause? As far as I know, no one has ever suggested that it is a categorical or an absolute. That is to say, when Congress said abridging, or when the Constitution said abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, it meant abridging any ability to speak or to publish. Were that the case, it would be impossible to have laws prohibiting the betraying of military secrets with the express purpose of helping the enemy, laws against mail fraud, laws forbidding incitement to murder. That sort of an interpretation is out. One would suppose then that what the courts would do would be what they generally do with regard to most of the other provisions of the Bill of Rights. That is, when this provision says abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, it means the freedom of speech or of the press of the sort that we have been accustomed to, of the sort that is part of our Anglo-Saxon tradition. The puzzlement I want to lay before you is that it seems to me that in this one area, the courts do not generally proceed in that fashion. They do not engage in an extensive analysis of what indeed the practice has been from the early days until today. By the way, when I speak of consulting the society's tradition, I don't want to get into the argument about whether you look back to 1789 and the tradition at that time, or whether you say traditions can change and we can have a societal consensus in 1986, which is somewhat different from what it was in 1789. I don't care which of those two views of tradition you want to take, neither one seems to be used by the Supreme Court when it comes to interpreting the speech and press clauses of the First Amendment. The best examples of the absence of that are the fields of pornography and libel law. In the latter, even those who don't like the direction in which the court has gone and who disagree with that direction do not debate it on the basis that that it's contrary to our traditions. Justice White's concurrence, you may recall, in Dun and Bradstreet, where he says he didn't like Gertz in the first place, does not say Gertz is simply contrary to our tradition, but rather he says, I still believe the common law rule should have been retained where a plaintiff is not a public official or public figure. As I see it, the court undervalued the reputational interest at stake in such cases. And then he goes to suggest other ways besides the rule of Gertz in which the court could have produced the results that it wanted. Not a resort to simply, this is the way our society has been formed, this is the way our traditions read, but simply, you could have done it better. As I say, I find the apparent unimportance of historical tradition in this field of curiosity. I'm at a loss to explain it, as I am the second curiosity that appears in the same field. That is what one might call the lack of any expressed play in the joints with respect to free speech and free press rights. In most other fields of constitutional law, the matter can and sometimes is be put by the court as follows. Granted that this is an ill-conceived and ultimately destructive law, is it so bad that the Constitution forbids it? There is a middle ground between what the Constitution prohibits and what makes good governmental sense. And within that middle ground, the states and the federal government are entitled to go to hell in a handbasket if they want to. But the courts don't speak that way in the First Amendment free speech and free press area. To hear them tell it, it is not a matter of whether it's so bad that it's unconstitutional, but rather it's a matter of whether the proper balance has in fact been reached in this case. Whether in fact the state interest in question outweighs the restriction of speech. Not does it outweigh it by so much that a state shouldn't be able to do it, but does it outweigh it, period. And so you have a whole lot of hyperbolic terms that are thrown about in this area. Compelling state interest, least restrictive alternative, or for that matter, even clear and present danger. I do not suggest that these hyperboles are in fact pursued to their logical conclusion. In fact, in many cases, it seems to me, a state interest quite less than what I would consider compelling is allowed to carry the day. And an alternative that seems to me not necessarily the least restrictive is allowed to be used by the state. But the point is that the court talks in those terms so that it can continue the theoretical construct of applying the free speech and free press clauses as absolutes, so that it is the function of the court to decide whether indeed there has been too much restriction. I don't know how to explain either of these two phenomena, but they do come through in the entire area. Perhaps the only explanation is accepting Irving Kristol's notion of the new class, that judges being part of the intelligentsia that are most benefited by this particular clause of the Constitution somehow seem to treat it with special solicitude. Thank you.
Um, Thank you very much, Professor Epstein.
Yeah, thank you. Following Nino seems to be something of a tradition in speeches, and every time I hear him talk, I'm tempted to scrap the speech that I've already given in order to write one which answers some of the queries that he's raised. This time, however, I've raised it to a fine art. That is, I had a hunch of what he would say, so that in advance of the speech, I think I wrote something which to some extent addresses the concerns that he wants to raise about the patterns of speech and so forth. The first thing I want to say about the subject in general is that, as is typical the case with constitutional law, I'm an outsider to the tradition. I've never taught the subject. I've written about it, but in a way which many people find, shall we say, incomprehensible to the received wisdom of what the subject is indeed about. And it seems to me that there's a certain virtue in ignorance, which Holmes once described as the best of law reformers, rather than trying to figure out in great detail the way in which the law has been organized and getting yourself seduced ever so quickly into the dominant categories of the received wisdom, it seems to me there's something to be said for taking a fresh look and starting over again to see if the categories that have emerged are in fact the ones that would emerge. Now, the title of this particular panel is something called Content-Based Discriminations under Distinctions under the First Amendment. And I confess that when I was asked to talk about it, I had not the slightest idea of what the thing meant. Indeed, I hurried over to Professor Stone and asked for a quick prepping as to what this is all about, and was told that there was a distinction between content-based and content-neutral restrictions, which was alluded to yesterday, and that within the area of content-based description, we covered an enormous amount of material. We talked about some of the subversive activity cases and whether or not the government had the power to restrain speech. We talked about libel cases. We talked about pornography. We talked about commercial speech. We talked about a broad range of subjects, which seems, I think, in a sensible view of the world, to cover most of the First Amendment issues. And it seems to me that when one looks at the body of law, that the original instinct of the outsider is in some sense correct. That is, the class is so broad, the distinctions within it are so manifold, that it seems to me that one is better reasoning to the content-based distinction, if one could reason to it at all, rather than beginning there and treating it as an article of First Amendment jurisprudence and trying to figure out precisely the way in which it works. And that's, I think, exactly what I'm going to try to do in the few minutes that are open to me, and I hope to explain two things. One, why there is a core of good sense about First Amendment doctrine, which is independent of the historical traditions, Nino's point, and why it is that the degree of deference which is shown to the court is seemingly low, and I think correctly so, again, in response, I think, to the second point that Nino has raised. Now, one thing that is characteristic about most modern constitutional law discussions is that they systematically shy away from the very question which seems to me has to be asked first. There was a question asked last night about why government at all, to which the panelists were noticeably reluctant to try to give any kind of an answer. And it seems to me that you cannot do constitutional theory unless you're prepared to face that kind of question, particularly if you think, as I happen to think, that one of the reasons why our Constitution is correct is not because it's a pastiche of clauses, but because it represents a coherent theoretical response to the question of why government and a theoretically coherent response to the form of government that we ought to have. So my approach is going to be rather different and to try to go back to fundamentals. And the fundamental, I think, that we have to go back to is not so much the idea of speech, but rather the full comprehensive phrase, which is freedom of speech, and to argue very naively that the idea of government, to some extent, is to preserve the freedoms and the liberties of the individuals whom it governs, and then to ask what are all the ambiguities which are associated with trying to work that program into some kind of coherent effect. Now, in order to do this, it seems to me that the first question you're going to have to ask is not what it is we mean by government, but rather what it is we mean by freedom. And there is, I think, a very powerful traditional distinction in the intellectual literature, which was not always reflected in the history, that there's a broad difference between freedom on the one hand and simply unlimited license to do what thou wilt on the other hand. That the theory of license effectively means do what you want, and the only way anybody can stop you is to do what he wants to do first. There is, in effect, under that view of the world, no place for government whatsoever. It is the law of the sword and the law of the stronger. And I don't think it takes a great imagination or any detailed game theoretical structure to explain that there's going to be a lot of blood on the floor if, in fact, that's the way in which one wishes not to organize a society. And the theory of freedom, in effect, is a theory which not only grants rights to individuals, but necessarily insists that there are correlative duties that are associated with these rights. And the question that we're going to have to ask, then, what's the content of those correlative duties? Now, if this were a straight discussion of political theory, I would start, I think, from an unabashedly consequentialist mode and try to explain why, in good utilitarian form, you would want to come up with something which looks pretty much like the Constitution and the protection of rights and freedom, which it, in fact, embodies. But in 10 minutes, it seems to me that that rather elaborate demonstration is something which is quite beyond my powers, even if I turn up the speedometer a little bit and try to talk faster. I'm doing already, so that what I will do is keep myself down, play my 33 record at 45 instead of turning it up to 78, and answer the narrow question, which is, what do we mean by the term freedom, which is in response to the constitutional question of interpretation. And here it seems to me that the history that I want to look to is not the sordid history of government before 1789. The reason, you know, I think that nobody looks at it is that it's a history of the repression of speech as much as its protection, and that the constitutional framers were philosophical radicals who were trying to break with established patterns, so the tradition would not carry that much weight with them. Instead, I look back to the tradition of Hobbes, Hume, and Locke, and so forth, and the basic definition that one wants to find, I think, of freedom is a restraint of the use of force or misrepresentation by other individuals which are directed against you. And it's an account of freedom which only speaks to the relationships between private parties and does not have an explicit governmental component. And the theory of government is, how is it going to be able to maintain that particular situation? Now, at this point, one can start with what I think to be a very nice kind of dilemma for the dilemma which the freedom of speech issue raised. That is, we have developed a general common law theory of tort, which by and large speaks about the rights that one individual has against another, if not in a state of nature, then at least in a set of circumstances where no person claims special status, privileges, or immunity by virtue of being a public servant. And the question is, how does that particular theory tie into the distinction made popular by many First Amendment theorists like Emerson between the theories of speech and action? And the point that I would want to make is that it cuts exactly at right angles to the distinction of the classical theorists. That is, if one were to start to look at the tort law, one would see very quickly that it turns out that there is no difference in principle between tortious acts which engage in speech and tortious acts which themselves involve action. That is, it turns out that as a theory of tort between private parties, there are some forms of actions which are fully protected, some forms of actions which are fully wrong. When you start to talk about speech, it turns out you have exactly the same thing. So that the hard question within a theory of freedom of speech is to figure out what are those classes of speech which are protected on the one hand, and what are those which are not protected on the other. The way in which I think the point can be made in its most visceral and vivid sense is to take the standard libertarian formulation and see in which the way in which it squares up with the protection or the limitations on the power of speech. One of the prohibitions that one sees with respect to private individuals is they're not allowed to use force. And every good libertarian quickly understands that the use of force includes not only the use of force, that is the gun fired, but the threat of the use of force. And the point is that a threat of force turns out in some sense to be a speech act, and therefore turns out to be on the illegal side of the law. And the hard question, therefore, as a matter of private rights, is to figure out what's the distinction between a threat of force on the one hand and certain kinds of conduct like political persuasion on the other hand, which would not be regarded as tortious. To make matters even more difficult, it turns out that when you're talking about a threat of force, you have to face the question of whether or not you're going to give injunctive relief or going to allow the force to take its course. And here the issue, it seems to me, is not so much one of primary rights, but rather one of error course. Are there dangers in suppressing talk too quickly, because now you get an ordinary persuasion? Are there dangers, to use the old common law expression, of waiting too long, because by the time you suppress the force, the harm will have occurred, and it will now be too late? And it seems to me, if one takes that kind of framework and works it back to the subversive activities cases, basically all you see is the public government trying to work out the question of how the relative quantities of the probability of harm, the severity of harm, the immediacy of harm, and alternative restraints apply with respect to that injunctive condition. Now, one can show with that particular area enormous amount of mess at the margins, because probabilities and severities are continuous quantities that vary by incremental degrees, and you could always bring a huge number of cases very close to the margin. But I think it would be a mistake to say that because we have close cases, we don't have clear cases. And it seems to me that one of the great achievements of the 1920s and the 1930s is they made clear that the consensus reached by the court in Abrams and Schenck was wrong, and that the dissent of Holmes and Abrams was probably correct. And while there's certainly kinds of dissonance at the margins, one ought not to assume that the confusion in doubtful cases simply overwhelms the real power and important institutional fact in those cases which are not litigated, but which are nonetheless clearly governed by rules. Now, the second part of the libertarian maxim is it says when you're looking at speech, you're not allowed to misrepresent or deceive. In other words, to be more bold, you're not allowed to lie. And it turns out, of course, that means that the line between truth and falsity, to which Gertz makes a great deal of reference, not only has constitutional decisions distinct, you know, importance because he said so, but because it's coherent and congruent with a substantive version of what the word freedom means when we take into account its substantive component. Under those circumstances, we then run into a parallel problem. The whole difficulty with the law of defamation is that sometimes we don't know whether speech is true or false, and under some circumstances, we don't know whether it's capable of being true and false. And in addition, when you start to talk about speech to large numbers of diffuse audiences, you have the same problem that you have with respect to subversive activities. What about an injunction before the fact on the grounds that the speech, when uttered and the fraud committed, it becomes too late in order to recover? And basically, it seems to me that the theory of freedom basically works itself out in the same way that it did before. It asks you to minimize the two kinds of errors, that of over and under enforcement. And as the point was made before, we can find excesses in one direction and excesses in another direction. But the good sense of a court is whether or not the clear cases are rightly defined. And when one, for example, like myself, takes issue with some of the commercial speech cases on the ground of underprotection, the basic argument is that the falsehood rationale, the falsehood prevention rationales are so tenuous, particularly with respect to means to ends, that one ought to be very suspicious about their involvement. Now, this then has to tie into the question of government, and here's the issue of deference with which I'll close. That is, I think the great success of the First Amendment interpretation, which is in sharp contrast to the abysmal failure of the property and economic liberties interpretations under other clauses of the Constitution, is that the courts have understood the right institutional framework. They have understood, in effect, that liberties are always subject to the depredations by special interests, and thus as a majority of 51% may vote to confiscate the wealth of 49%, there's the risk that they'll vote to suppress the rights of speech of those kinds of minorities. So that what has happened, it has decided that it cannot be deferential with respect to intervention, precisely because it understands that the political process is inherently unstable and, if left unchecked, will result in a series of degenerative and irreversible alternatives. Now, if they had understood more about that with property, it seems to me that substantive due process would not have had the bad name it received. The contracts clause and the takings clause would have been better. But what I'd like to leave you with is exactly that point, which is that if you understand what freedom is about under the speech, you could forget about all the historical debates. You can forget about all the talk about internal, you know, original intention. You could basically take the text and drive it very powerfully and get yourself a set of clear and determinate results. And it seems to me that that's extraordinarily important under these circumstances because it allows one to basically answer the dilemma that has always divided the Federalist Society. One could be a strict constructionist, as indeed I am with respect to these issues, and also believe that we need a very heavy dose of judicial activism, which is constrained and informed by constitutional theory.
Practicing lawyers stand. Judges are used to sitting when they speak, and professors sometimes stand and sometimes sit. Professor McConnell said something very interesting in the first panel here today. I'm really almost rendered speechless by. He said that the rule of choice as to how people were picked to appear here today is to have one professor from the University of Chicago, Professor Epstein, and one serious candidate for the Supreme Court. Now, one chance out of three is a lot better than I came with today. So I feel very good about being here, and I want Mr. Reese in particular to listen very carefully to what I say. If the President wants to spring a surprise. You never know what answers I'll give to your questions. To speak as our title bids us today, of permissible and impermissible content restrictions, is to assume, I think, two things. One is that there are some content-based restrictions on speech that are permissible. And that is, even the most occasional reader of the Espionage Act, obscenity law, libel law, will readily acknowledge is certainly an accurate statement of law. So is the corollary, I would hope, more normative proposition that most, if not all, content-based restrictions on speech are unconstitutional. That, at least so the cases say, is the rule. But what does it all mean? And is the difference, I suspect I have with some members of the panel here, if not all, and some members of the audience, if not all, one of the inevitable ones that simply arises when different people are asked to draw lines in areas in which even frighteningly reasonable people can easily differ? I don't think so, and I'm going to try to say why. Constitutional law, all law, involves words. It also involves music. Words, especially the rather bland ones we tend to use with each other, lawyers and judges, often tend to blur and ultimately conceal underlying reality. They distort, however inadvertently, what is actually occurring by smothering reality under an avalanche of legal verbiage. To hear the music, I think, is to comprehend what is really happening. I don't always find this an intolerable situation, but it makes it important to listen carefully. Sometimes in First Amendment contexts, we use words which set forth legal tests which are so deliberately difficult, if not quite impossible, to meet, that we can say with some confidence that we have a rule of law that makes suppression of speech in this or that area all but impossible. That is the law now with respect to prior restraints. Although not absolutely banned, they are, in fact, virtually non-existent because First Amendment law makes them so very difficult to obtain. So it is as well with the law of constructive contempt, the power of judges to jail journalists for what they write about judicial proceedings. And the words of our decisions may leave open some faint possibility that someday, in some case, for some reason or other, some judge may hold a journalist in contempt for what he writes about a judicial proceeding and that it may be affirmed. But the music of the cases we have had tell us that we live in a country in which that simply does not happen. And that is so, I would argue to you, and it would be so, I would argue to you, whether we read the First Amendment by italicizing the word "the," as Judge Scalia tends to, or the word "no," as I tend to. Which brings me to our topic today. And the reason that I find the music currently in the air with respect to content-based restrictions on speech so increasingly discordant. Consider what's happened in the First Amendment area. There was a time in which we dealt, to the consternation, I should say, of most academics, with categories. We may not have been sure what fighting words were, what commercial speech was, and of course, what was and what was not obscene, but we knew if that's what we were talking about, it was unprotected speech. And if we were talking about other sorts of speech, we knew or thought we knew that we were talking about protected speech. I know, not always protected speech, but the rule, that which we lived by, was that it was protected. And then we proceeded to other, to be sure, more complicated areas. If a draft card was burned to protest the war in Vietnam, we were told it was unprotected under the First Amendment, not just because what was involved may not have been speech at all, but because even if it was, the statute involved was within the constitutional power of our government, because it furthered a substantial government interest which was unrelated to the suppression of opinion, because it did so in a manner which restricted First Amendment activity, so the court told us, no greater than was essential to the furtherance of the governmental interest. And that, of course, is United States against O'Brien. I will leave the wisdom of that case for another day, except to say that what made it bearable, if not my candidate for a Freedom Award, was that it did arise in a conceptually difficult area in which speech and non-speech elements overlap, one in which I might well have said that there was no First Amendment issue at all because it wasn't speech. and because it said that the governmental interest had to be unrelated to the suppression of free expression, and because it said that the statute had to be narrowly drafted as possible to serve its supposed end. Which brings me to a case decided last week, one which returns me at least to my dichotomy of words and music, and one which leads me to tell you that whatever the words of the court may be in cases in which content neutrality is said to be present, you would do well to listen very closely indeed to the underlying melody. Here in briefest forms were the facts in Renton versus Playtime Theater, decided last Tuesday. A city in Washington state passed a law prohibiting any adult motion picture theater from locating within 1,000 feet from any residential zone, single or multiple family dwelling, church, or park. Theaters were banned within 1 mile of any school, those theaters. When the owner of 2 such theaters in downtown Renton sued, the 1 mile limit was amended so that those theaters then became 1,000 feet, a flat rule then of 1,000-foot limit. The district court held the statute was constitutional. On appeal, the Court of Appeals for the Ninth Circuit held that under O'Brien, the statute, which applied only to adult theaters, was not content neutral, since, among other things, the city had failed to show that the statute was unrelated to the suppression of expression. Of course, the Supreme Court reversed, not just because it tends to reverse decisions of the Ninth Circuit, a badge of honor, perhaps, for that court, but because the court had misapplied O'Brien. The Renton statute, applying only to adult theaters, Justice Rehnquist wrote, was aimed not at the content of films shown at adult motion picture theaters, but rather at the secondary effects of such theaters on the surrounding community. Thus, the court said, the question was simply whether the statute was designed to serve a substantial government interest and whether it allowed for reasonable alternative avenues of communication. Well, I know that Justice Brennan's voice may not fall upon entirely receptive ears in at least one part of the audience here today, but is he really wrong in saying that that ordinance discriminates on its face against certain forms of speech based upon content? Is he really to be dismissed when he says that the selective treatment by Renton of adult movie theaters, but not other movie theaters, quote, strongly suggests, unquote, that Renton was interested not just in the supposed secondary effects of adult theaters, but in the films themselves? Is that really untoward judicial activism, the dissenting opinion, the illegitimate pouring of one's own values into the Bill of Rights? Or in Renton, as in so many other recent First Amendment cases of the Supreme Court, are not the activists, if that is the curse word of the day, those members of the court so busy pouring their own views into the First Amendment that they are unwilling even to adhere to the spirit of such watered-down First Amendment protections as cases such as O'Brien provide? I cite Renton to you only in part to demonstrate the ease with which content-neutral, non-content-neutral distinction can be manipulated by a court ever less responsive to First Amendment claims. I cite it to you also to show that when the Supreme Court chooses to play music which drowns out First Amendment interests, no tests based upon the distinction between that which is content neutral and that which is not are of much avail. Indeed, if we accept the proposition that the statute in Renton was content neutral, the application of that case to others that may lie ahead is deeply troubling. If adult movie theaters may be zoned nearly, if totally, out of existence because they lead to crowds, noise, whatever, but not, of course, because of the movies they show, what about movies that show punk rock movies, or movies, if you'll forgive my effort at making this relevant today, about right-wing professors of law? You know the sort of crowds those movies would draw. But are they really content-neutral statutes? And if so, are we, let me say it bluntly, speaking the same language? And what if a statute is content neutral? Is that really to be virtually the end of the matter? Would a law that banned all movie theaters in Renton with serene indifference to what they show be constitutional if it is said to serve the governmental interest of avoiding noise and litter on the street, and so long as other means of communication remain available? Are we now prepared in other areas to say that because leaflets lead to litter and sound trucks to noise, that they, in contravention of long-standing Supreme Court precedents, may now be effectively zoned out of existence, so long as we do so in a content-neutral way? Consider a statute which makes illegal car radios in the interest of protecting traffic safety. Such a statute would be content-neutral. It would be directly related to the societal end which is sought of having drivers focus on driving. It would serve the governmental interest involved. Indeed, a court might well say it would serve it very narrowly and precisely. I think it's fair to say in cases and situations such as this that we have lost sight of core First Amendment values when we started down these roads. Now, of course, I may be reading Renton too closely. Maybe the music of Renton is not what is content neutral and what is not content neutral, but simply our difficulty of dealing in a matter satisfactory to us with sex, or at least sexually explicit materials that we have previously said are constitutionally protected. But to say that is to say, as Justice Stevens did far more forthrightly in the American Mini Theaters case of a decade ago, that we are restricting speech because of its content, not without regard to its content. I offer a final word to those of you in the Federalist Society. I wondered why you invited me. I was delighted to be invited. I have read your literature, and I see that you describe yourself, at least in part, as libertarian. Some of you have described the organization to me as one which believes deeply in the principle of private ownership of property. To those people that share those views, I ask you to consider whether you can possibly square the Renton case and others like it with your beliefs. The music of the Renton case is, alas, too often the music of the Supreme Court today. But this organization should know better. Thank you.
Surely the most important thing to note on the topic of permissible and impermissible content-based restrictions on freedom of speech is that for most of our history, and until not very long ago, there were no impermissible restrictions, at least as far as state law was concerned. Can you believe that as recently as 1922, the Supreme Court was able to state, "The Constitution of the United States imposes upon the states no obligation to confer upon those within their jurisdiction the right of freedom of speech. Neither the 14th Amendment nor any other provision of the Constitution of the United States imposes upon the states any restrictions about freedom of speech," unquote. That certainly has a shocking ring to constitutional law junkies today. But the short answer to the speech problems we are struggling with here today is that in 1922, the Supreme Court had it right. And it has since gone badly astray. I also cannot resist telling you about Fox v. Washington, decided a few years earlier, unanimous Supreme Court opinion by Justice Holmes. The case involved the constitutionality of a state statute that made it a crime willfully to publish or distribute any writing which shall tend to encourage or advocate disrespect for law or for any court or courts of justice, something I violate twice a day. Surely, as any contemporary First Amendment scholar, no contemporary First Amendment scholar could be of any other opinion, then that a more clearly unconstitutional statute would be difficult to find. I'm happy to be able to report to you, therefore, that they are incorrect. That Justice Holmes, the patron saint of First Amendment law, saw no problem with the statute at all. Poor defendant in this particular case was a nudist, and some of his fellow exhibitionists had been arrested, as was to be expected in those more upright times, for indecent exposure. The defendant then published an indignant article entitled "The Nude and the Prudes." And Justice Holmes, the inveterate scoffer, could not resist quoting this article at length. The article said that the nudists were, quote, "a community of free spirits who came out of the woods to escape the polluted atmosphere of priest-ridden conventional society." And that one of the liberties they enjoyed, still quoting, was the privilege to bathe in evening clothes, all with merely the clothes nature gave them, just as they chose, unquote. This Eden was interrupted, however, when, quote, "a few prudes got into the community and proceeded in the brutal, unneighborly way of the outside world to suppress the people's freedom," unquote. I am unable to read this in the U.S. reports without hearing old Holmes chuckle. The article went too far, however, when it predicted that the prudes would be boycotted and, quote, "will come to see the brutal mistake of their action and so inform the people," unquote, whatever that means. That, Holmes said, was quite enough to support a conviction of violating the statute by encouraging a breach of the state's indecent exposure law. Without even mentioning the First Amendment, Holmes quickly rejected a challenge to the law as unduly vague and ended with his customary observation, quote, "of course, we have nothing to do with the wisdom of the defendant, the prosecution, or the act." And I personally think you would have liked to have added, "especially of the defendant." Contemporary constitutional law scholars take it as a given that it is only the eternal vigilance of the Supreme Court in enforcing its notions of the First Amendment against the states that saves us from a nationwide regime of enforced silence. These cases remind us, however, that the nation did once manage to survive, and apparently survived quite well, without federal constitutional restrictions on state regulation of speech. The Supreme Court is not necessary, I suggest, to protect the freedom of speech that everyone agrees is necessary in a democracy. It is necessary only to enforce that notion of freedom of speech that disables the states from restricting pornography, vulgarity, nudity, and marches by Nazis through the neighborhoods of concentration camp victims. The question of the validity of so-called content-based restrictions on speech comes up most often today in connection with state efforts to restrict the distribution of pornography. I suspect that the objection to the suppression of pornography on grounds of a threat to freedom of speech is an example of a category mistake. Not everything that can be put on paper or between covers should necessarily be categorized as speech. The regulation of pornography, of sexually stimulating material useful as a masturbatory aid, is probably closer to the regulation of chemical substances than to the control of the processes of communication. Pornography is more a thing than an appeal to the reasoning process, and its connection to concerns about freedom of communication seem largely fortuitous. But whether or not pornography is itself speech, the argument is made, it must be protected because its suppression would unacceptably danger true speech, due to the difficulty or impossibility of defining pornography. After practicing both pornography law and antitrust law at one time, my first reaction to this argument is that I can probably define pornography with greater definiteness than I can define a conspiracy and restraint of trade. History can again give us some reassurance as to this alleged difficulty. If pornography is really so difficult to define, it is remarkable that our cities were once able to suppress it so successfully that when I was a boy some 40 years ago, the most erotically titillating material available in New York City, New York City, mind you, not Dubuque, was the National Geographic. When Fiorello LaGuardia was mayor of New York and closed down Minsky's and the other famous burlesque houses and generally cleaned up the city, the police had no difficulty in defining pornography. They knew it meant dirty pictures. And that meant pictures of naked women. Or, in more technical terms, pictures of women so undressed that they ought not to be permitted outside of an art museum. For a long time, and up until the mid-1950s, the person in charge of deciding what was mailable matter in the United States was a post office official named O'Brien, which of course is itself a good start to solving this problem. Incredible as it seems today, until the late 1950s, pornographic materials could not be sent through the United States mail. Mr. O'Brien saw to that. And he, too, had no difficulty in defining pornography. To him, it meant simply pubic hair. You could publish and mail magazines with pictures of naked men and women. They could run and jump, bend over, even spread their legs. They just couldn't have genitals or pubic hair. Which gave rise to what became known as the crotchless generation. Crude, perhaps, but it seemed to work just fine. Until the Warren Court, ever ready to break the fetters imposed on the human soul by lesser minds, decreed that nudity was okay after all. Genitals and pubic hair were not obscene. And thus was born Hustler magazine. If we are unable to suppress pornography today, it is not, I submit, because we're unable to define it. The human mind and imagination have not deteriorated that much since the days of Mayor LaGuardia and Postmaster O'Brien. It is instructive to compare Mr. O'Brien's primitive and childlike efforts to define pornography with what has now been achieved at the acme of American jurisprudence. By the United States Supreme Court. Not, of course, that it would be fair to expect from a humble civil servant like Mr. O'Brien what one can expect from, say, a Harry Blackman. Suppressible obscenity, according to the latest ruling of the Supreme Court, is material that, as you know, among other things, appeals to the prurient interest, and that is, material, quote, material having a tendency to excite lustful thoughts. So far, so good, you might be saying. They obviously just mean dirty pictures. But it turns out, unfortunately, to be a much more subtle matter. It is not just any lustful thought that will do. The material must excite a particular kind of lustful thought. Now, lustful thought is something I happen to know something about. And always felt like just a student of obscenity that I knew them when I saw them. But even I have to admit that in telling the okay lustful thoughts, the ones you have a constitutional right to excite, from the other kind, I'm no good at all. As Justice White explained the distinction, this is it, I kid you not, If the material, quote, taken as a whole, does no more than arouse good, old-fashioned, healthy interest in sex, the healthy, wholesome human reaction common to millions of well-adjusted persons in our society, unquote, then it is okay and constitutionally protected. If, however, the material arouses unhealthy, unwholesome, newfangled kind of luster. The Constitution says the hell with it. So that's the test. You look at the material, you say, just what kind of lustful thought is this arousing? Poor Mr. O'Brien, the child. Anyone should retain a lingering belief that there is some element of intellectual respectability in constitutional law. I recommend you read the court's pornography decisions and ponder this distinction. The cutting edge in pornography field today is, of course, the notion that it somehow constitutes a violation of the civil rights of women. Catherine McKinnon of the University of Minnesota Law Faculty and Andrea Dworkin, the author of Pornography, Men Possessing Women, drafted a proposed statute taking this approach. It is difficult to see their proposal as a serious effort to restrict pornography rather than an attention-getting exercise in feminist propaganda. Although it does point out to us that we were mistaken all these years in dividing human beings into the traditional groups of men, women, and children. It now turns out there's a distinct fourth group previously overlooked, transsexuals. The proposal tells us, unhelpfully and with no plausibility, that, quote, pornography is a form of discrimination on the basis of sex and the sexually explicit subordination of women. As much as I prefer representative self-government to government by judges, I have to admit the adoption of this proposal by two city councils in two different cities is the best argument against democracy I've heard in some time. Although adopted by the City Council of Minneapolis, the proposal did not become law in Minneapolis because it was vetoed by the mayor. In perhaps what is the most bizarre incident in the story of this bizarre proposal, the mayor of Minneapolis was then publicly berated for abuse of office by no less an authority on the subject of constitutional government than the Harvard Law School's Tyler Professor of Constitutional Law. The mayor's veto, Professor Lawrence Tribe wrote to the city council, is, quote, an abuse of the fundamental structure of our system of government. By acting unilaterally, he deprived the courts of their unique constitutional function and usurped the judicial function. Unquote. I was, as you could expect, deeply shaken to learn this from Professor Tribe, because it provided a dramatic reminder of just how mistaken one can be. Had a student in my first year constitutional law class argued that an executive should not veto proposed legislation that he considers unconstitutional, even one of the most preposterous pieces of legislation imaginable, because it would deprive the courts of an opportunity to pass on its constitutionality, I would have told him that unless he got a better grasp of our system of government, he would never go far in the field of constitutional law. Although the proposal was never enacted in Minneapolis, to Professor Tribe's chagrin, it was enacted, I'm sorry to say, in Indianapolis. It was immediately challenged by an association of booksellers and held unconstitutional by the Federal District Court. This decision was upheld by the Seventh Circuit in an opinion by Judge Easterbrook. And that decision, as you know, was affirmed on appeal by the Supreme Court a couple of weeks ago. Judge Easterbrook's opinion could not, in my opinion, be any better if it had been written by Justice Brennan himself.
What are we supposed to make of that?
In it, Judge Easterbrook tells us such things as that, quote, under the First Amendment, there is no such thing as a false idea. The First Amendment is slightly gaga. In my opinion, when a federal court holds a state statute or a city ordinance, for that matter, unconstitutional, even a crazy one like this, it should do so with humility, reluctance, and regret. It should not be an occasion for issuing foolish ringing declarations. This is all, unfortunately, I have time to say about Judge Easterbrook's opinion, except that I agree with concurring Judge Swigart that Frank could have gotten away with saying a great deal less. Thank you.
Well, thank all of you. It's an extraordinary performance by all four of you. I would have gotten the hook out, Professor Grady, but you were so amusing. I couldn't. There's no way I could. And so good. So I. But we can run a little longer than the 12:30 if there are questions from the audience. Because if anyone has a question from the panel, that would be. But have a prior right. Do you have a question?
No, I'm not a small two-minute comment. Yeah, I think that there's actually, oddly enough, a profound ground of agreement between Laura Floyd Abrams and Lino Graglia, although I don't think they would recognize it, and that is the importance of using...
At least one of us doesn't.
Well, but let me explain what it is. It seems to me that basically they're... Both, and I agree with this sentiment, is the importance of categorical determinations in constitutional law. That is, I much prefer a rule which talks about pubic hair than talks about healthy responses if one is going to assume that there is some scope for government regulation with respect to pornography at all, precisely because one of the things that I fear most about governance is, in fact, the degree of discretion that comes with classifications. And it seems to me that the same point could be made with respect to the Renton case, and the ability to start to deal with adult theaters is that one of the things that one is enormously afraid of in government is the ability to select various kinds of speech and so forth, and to decide that it's going to be subject to some kinds of restrictions and not to others. And I think that the contra-neutral distinction, contra-neutral regulation is generally going to be better than select content regulation, precisely because in the inability to select, it means that the only way that you can inflict harm upon thy neighbor is to inflict some degree of harm upon yourself. And the other point that I want to raise, which I think does deal with disagreement with Floyd Abrams implicit, is I think that the opinion in Renton is wrong on two grounds. That is, one way is to argue that it got the First Amendment issue screwed up because it didn't pay sufficient attention to the public nuisance side. But I think, in effect, one of the difficulties of your position is that you don't take after Euclid against Ambler. That is, this is indeed a zoning case. And one of the key questions that you always have to ask is, what's the rationale for zoning generally before you start to get to the question, what's the rationale for zoning with respect to freedom of speech? And generally, the rationale for zoning is rent-seeking. It's an effort to suppress your competitors so that you could have increased value to your own property. And I would submit that these cases would be much easier to decide if, in fact, one took a tougher view with respect to zoning regulation generally. And that the great problem in many ways of First Amendment jurisprudence, be it under the religion clause or under the speech clause, is that we've conceded so much to the size of government with respect to the property provisions that the only way you can make any sensible control over them is to take the speech provisions and to push them far broader than one might have otherwise want. And that it would be a far easier and more coherent rule if we took the idea of not judicial activism, but at least the idea of responsible judicial limitations on government behavior and applied it across the full panoply of freedoms. Because otherwise, you're left with the very uneasy sense that some freedoms are better than others. And it seems to me not the Warren Court, not Floyd Abrams, not anybody has been able to give a coherent and sustained rationalization why that proposition ought to be true.
I just wanted to say about Professor Epstein's rejoinder to my initial remark, you did come loaded.
Yeah, sure.
I find it difficult. I find it difficult to believe that the same person who gave us the test of First Amendment constitutionality that Professor Epstein did, and I tried to take notes, but it was difficult.
You're not alone.
I find it difficult to believe that is the same person who likes clear and simple rules like pubic hair. There is no way that the federal judiciary is going to be able to apply Hobbes and Locke according to your desires.
I don't. You just have to try a little harder. I don't see any difficulty. Any difficulty opinion whatsoever.
You flatter us, Richard. You flatter us.
Well, I mean, the point is, you don't have to think of why the rules are right. And, you know, all you have to do is apply them. We'll do the thinking for you. I mean.
I'll wait till I get the printed text. Maybe it'll be clearer then. But beyond that, I find it difficult to believe that the society that adopted the Constitution thought that it was adopting Hobbes and Locke, whatever that might lead to. It's sort of like a constitutional Graham Rudman, isn't it?
No. It's like a constitutional protection of lives, liberties, and estates.
To the contrary, I think it was a society that had certain traditions, certain understandings, one of which was the understanding about what is and what isn't pornography, and whether that's entitled to free speech. And I don't think there was any intention of upsetting those settled notions. I want to make one remark about what Floyd Abrams said. I tend to agree with Mr. Abrams that the rationale of Renton is difficult to understand. Whether indeed it was the secondary effect of the pornography rather than the pornography itself that was behind the ordinance, but that decision of the Supreme Court and the attempt to somehow squeeze pornography into civil rights laws as discrimination against women, both of those phenomena demonstrate, I think, that tradition will out. You can try to stomp it down and ignore it in First Amendment jurisprudence or elsewhere, but it will pop up again. Societies that have no written constitution have their traditions which serve the same purpose. And I think the same thing will ultimately be the case with our constitution, although there will be some erosion. But ultimately, the logic of the opinions will not stand because they will have to be the logic will have to be compromised in order to make room for society's continued revulsion against certain forms of speech. Renton is one example. The Catherine MacKinnon attempt to do the same thing. Would
you sustain it?
Would I sustain what?
The statute against constitutional challenge.
Under current law, no.
I mean, if you, as it were, elevated.
Well, listen,
there's room for just one of us at this table.
I just do what I'm told, Richard.
Then strike it down.
I just wanted to make one comment about Professor Grolier's remarks. I think he provides a dramatic reminder of why we need a First Amendment, and why we need one, and why we need one applicable to the states. I think I'm entitled to see Kramer versus Kramer, with its one, if you'll forgive the expression, pubic hair nude scene in it. And even if Mr. O'Brien doesn't like it, and even if you don't like it, I think it's none of your business what I see in my home. I understand it used to be easier. I know what a dirty picture is too. What was wrong with it is that you were taking away from me the right to see something which didn't do anybody any harm and which I wanted to see. And
you know,
it seems to me absolutely outrageous to take the position that because something is a clearer line in this area, and of course having no pictures as the Ayatollah would want it, of an uncovered face would be clearer still, absolutely outrageous to take the position that because the personal preference of a legislator, or you, Professor Grolier, is that I never see a picture with pubic hair, that can be embodied into law without even the chance to challenge it under the First Amendment.
I think you're making a basic mistaken assumption of fact. The fact is, as far as I'm concerned, you can see all the pubic hair you want. I got nothing against it. I have turned down few opportunities myself. What I'd like to tell you, Mr. Abrams, though, is that I would rather be ruled on these questions and all others by my fellow citizens than by the ACLU, because the ACLU can really go crazy. The ACLU can have notions that no sensible person can have.
Do you mean the courts, Professor? Are you using the word ACLU as synonymous with the word Supreme Court of the United States?
I take constitutional law to be simply a ruse for the enactment of the program of the ACLU.
I disagree.
Now, you found the right audience.
That may strike you as perhaps a striking statement.
It happens
that we could go down the list. I mean, what is the position of the ACLU on prayer in the schools? And what is the Supreme Court's position? What is the position of the ACLU on busing and the Supreme Court's position? On abortion and the Supreme Court's position? And so on criminal procedure. Is there a difference? Is it a coincidence? Is it random that the ACLU never loses?
They lost Renton. Did you and we?
I mean, they sometimes don't win.
But that's
that's right. That is sometimes.
By the way, I mean.
Time out.
I mean.
If the audience is to participate in this, we have to. We have to let some questions from the audience. Excuse me.
Majority rule has taken its most devastating blow.
As to Mr. Abrams, I mean, we all want all sorts of things, and we'd all like to see all sorts of things. I'm not sure that that's enormously helpful in figuring out what the Constitution means, so I don't really know that that's a very useful starting point. I have a question for Richard, which is, What do you do about state regulation of pornography during the period that where the states had First Amendments and it was clear that the courts were not applying the First Amendment to the states, to the national First Amendment to the states, but the states had their own, and it was quite clear during that period that laws regarding pornography were considered to be legal. How do you explain that in terms of Hume, Locke, the basis of the First Amendment?
I think basically one has to start with the history of this, and it turns out that in opposition to the freedom of anything, that is speech, contract, and so forth, there was this sort of category in traditional discourse of the police powers of the state, which survived the passage of individual constitutional amendments. And basically, there were several heads under the police power, only one of which is controversial, and that turns out to be the morals head. That is, you've got the safe and the healthy of the people, and then you've got the morals question. And the traditional battle in all of these areas is precisely how broad a scope does one give to the morals exceptions to the police power within a profound theory of individual freedom. And it seems to me that the real question there is basically in viewing pornography, and here I'm not giving Nino instructors marching orders what to do, but trying to think aloud about the problem, is that you have to ask yourself as to whether or not this is a case in which there's a kind of a serious externality, which would be akin with the pollution of the public waters or the commission of murder and something of the sort. And I find that the pornography case is extremely difficult in principle to answer, because they seem to me to raise the question of anticipatory problems. That is, if in fact it turns out that you show certain kinds of violent movies, so forth, will that induce people to do certain other things which will cause harm? My own instinct, and this is where I come down, is I, by and large, would be very cautious to sort of make, you know, to extend, I'm speaking cautiously, to extend the power of the state to regulate with respect to most forms of pornography. On that issue, I'm much closer to Floyd Abrams than I am, I think, to Lino Graglia. And what I would want to do in seeing it is to whether or not one sees in the operation of pornography, either at an individual or a systematic level, something which suggests the creation of serious forms of external harm. And generally speaking, I guess I don't find it. What is different, I suppose, about us is the way in which we make that determination. I think the Floyd Abrams determination is something on which you take judicial notice that it just can't happen. And the Richard Epstein view about all of this is that when you're dealing with compelling state interests and so forth, it may be that you set the burdens, but one is at least willing to look at the kind of empirical evidence that people might be able to bring before a court to show that at least in certain kinds of cases, the externalities exist, that, you know, these theaters have a habit of reaching out and bringing in 11-year-old impressionable boys and girls in there, that the guys who want to take teenage girls and turn them into prostitutes hang around these kinds of theaters and nab them and so forth. Then I'm still not happy because I'd want to ask about lesser restrictive alternatives. I mean, what I think the ultimate difficulty in constitutional law is that in the question, the battle between definition and justification, that is, do we just want to define speech to exclude pornography or do we want strict justification? You can't use one tactic to the exclusion of the others. You can't define speech so as to exclude it or to include it, and you got to face the justification questions. And my general instinct would be I'd want to put a very heavy burden upon the state, and I think that the court, Warren Court or otherwise, is generally right to give the morals exception under the police power a very hard look. And so that's where I sort of come down.
Was that a yes or a no?
The answer to that question is that the strong presumption is that the statute doesn't stand unless you can show a very close linkage to the kinds of external harms that you have a right to prevent, which is very close to the O'Brien formulation. I don't think you can avoid intermediate cases, but I think you have to be able to get the margins in the right place.
I have a question mainly for Mr. Abrams. Richard Epstein may want to take a crack at it, too.
No.
If we admit the theoretical incoherence of the obscenity exception that the Supreme Court has erected in regulating pornography, if we take the position that that it's illegitimate for the government to dictate what adults may see and read, is it possible to fashion an exception that protects children from either the public display or private sale of graphic sexual images, which obviously requires a content-based restriction? Or are we driven to the conclusion that a constitution which allows restrictions on the sale of pornography to children is also bound to allow restrictions on the sale of, say, Republican Party literature to children, leaving aside the question of which would be more warping to an impressionable mind?
I think we can have, and so far the law has recognized the appropriateness of special care with respect to children in this area in particular. The Ferber case so holds. In terms of photos of children, there are laws which make it, which are perfectly constitutional in my view, which make it legal, which make it illegal to take the pictures, illegal to sell the pictures. Public nuisance laws, it seems to me quite properly, can make it illegal to display certain pictures in windows, regardless of what you can sell. So I think though all those things can be dealt with. I was not incidentally taking the position that what people here call pornography, the law talks about obscenity, that all such materials are outside the realm of that which the state may touch. While it's very difficult, as the Supreme Court has found, to define what it is that it is illegal to sell outside the area of children's pictures and the like, it seems to me that for historical reasons, as Justice Scalia points to in his earlier statement, and for other reasons, this is one of the categories, however you define what falls in it, that I think is a proper one to lie outside the area of full First Amendment protection.
I basically agree on the simple theory that whenever you talk about freedom, the incompetence of children has always been an exception. And if that's an argument with respect to contract, it would work quite well with respect to pornography and speech.
I never understood the special treatment of pornography with respect to children. If there's nothing wrong with pornography for adults, I don't see particularly why one draws a great dividing line between children's access to it. If it's not harmful or proscribable stuff, why is it proscribable for children?
Because they don't have full capacity.
Capacity for what? If it's not harmful, should you restrict them from milk as well?
Well, you restrict them from contracting.
If it's all perfectly good and natural and healthy,
I can't. Basically, this is another one of the devices that are just trying to retain as much of the traditional rule that allowed the society to proscribe pornography as possible. It doesn't make much logical sense. Every society has had some rules that are not rules based upon harm to other persons. Our rules on monogamy, for example, has monogamy been demonstrated to be the only socially healthful system? There are other societies that have bigamous legal systems that seem to thrive quite well. Now, is that to be stricken down as
yes?
You should have heard it.
Holzer's speech was right, and there's no answer to it that has been given except for the question of why not.
This happens not to be the kind of a society that want to live in.
No, it is the kind. I mean, if you're a Mormon, is the kind of society in which you most definitely want to live in. I mean, the whole point of a constitution is to place a bulwark against tradition, and when you have many different traditions that conflict, you can't rely on consensus, so you have to turn to law. And the basic kind of gibberish that one sees in the Reynolds opinion that supports its result is, I think, generally unpardonable. One has to develop a theory of freedom which applies to religion as well as to everything else, and I don't see the externality of the bigamy cases. It seems to me it's just a sheer state grab which is consistent with everything else that the federal government did to the Mormons when they had them under territorial control. A pattern of systematic expropriation and repression, which we ought to be as ashamed of as we were with respect to the Japanese internments, which took place around the Second World War.
Richard, I am I didn't want to join this discussion, but I am compelled to comment upon Richard's theologically inaccurate statements. It is not the case that Mormons believe in bigamy. Fortunately, due to the latest direct word from the top to the leader, it is, well, Richard, let's keep it straight. The Mormons don't believe in bigamy. You're talking about some prior, more primitive form of the religion.
Yes. Those corrections I could survive.
I have a question I'd like to put to Mr. Abrams.
No pick issue. Up Please speak up.
A couple questions for Mr. Abrams. Pick up on something. That
you should speak up to the microphone.
Into the microphone.
Pick the microphone up a little bit.
Speak into the microphone. We can't hear it.
Sing.
All right. How's that?
All right.
No. Closer.
How's that?
The microphone may be off.
Okay. I'll repeat it to them if I like.
This is for Mr. Abrams. All right. You said that you think the First Amendment should apply to the states. Now, maybe you're right as a matter of social or legal policy, but it wasn't until 1925 that the Supreme Court did that in Gitlow v. New York. We went 57 years from the ratification of the 14th Amendment before the Supreme Court discovered somehow that the First Amendment did apply to the states. Now, what, aside from your belief that it should apply to the states, by what right did the court have the authority to apply the First Amendment to the states?
Well, the 14th Amendment has some language in it. It's the role of the courts to interpret what that language means. I think everyone would agree, I know some of you don't think we have a 14th Amendment, but those of you that will concede to me arguendo that the 14th Amendment exists, ought to concede as well that it then has to fall to the judiciary when a case is properly before the courts to decide the meaning of what a liberty interest is, the meaning of what due process means, and the like. Did they decide it correctly when they first haltingly and then ever more self-assuredly said that the First Amendment applies to the states? Or that the Due Process Clause incorporated ever more provisions of the Bill of Rights? I think they did. I think there's a strong historical argument, which I'm not prepared to give you right now, but a strong historical argument about the intentions of the draftsman of the 14th Amendment in terms of applying at least the core provisions of the Bill of Rights to the states. That's where I would look first, and that's where I think the courts went and looked. So on this one, I am not, as you know, advocating a massive change in law when I say that the First Amendment applies to the states.
Well, I would. Charles Fairman wrote an article in the 1949 edition of this university's law. 49 that I would refer everyone to on that, the question of the historical intent of the framers of the 14th Amendment.
Yeah, but you also miss the Privileges and Immunities Clause, which if it had not been eviscerated in Slaughterhouse would have been a much cleaner route.
This is a somewhat long question to Professor Epstein.
I only ask long questions.
I wonder he'll give a short answer.
I wonder if you. I wonder if you haven't put forward a somewhat overly broad notion of misrepresentation. You pointed to and fraud. You see in your book takings reputation as a property interest.
No.
But I wonder if perhaps you're not neglecting a logically prior property right, namely the Lockean notion of self-ownership. And isn't reputation in the minds of other people, not the person whose reputation it is? And doesn't it, at least at first glance, appear that defamation law is somehow reaching into the minds of other people, violating their right of self-ownership? And aren't you perhaps setting up a legally enforceable duty to always tell the truth that could have some rather extreme consequences in terms of state power?
Yeah, well, I think the mistake is to equate the law of reputation, or the law of defamation, with the protection of reputation as such. It's the protection of reputation against false statements to third persons. And the whole theory is that to the extent that you lie to somebody so that he doesn't interact with the plaintiff, there's been a loss of gainful economic exchanges as much as if you fired bullets at them. And it's quite, and the line, therefore, is if you make true statements about that fellow which cause a diminution in utility, then it seems to me that he's got no complaints. So I don't think I've misstated the law of misrepresentation. I think the real hard question is how you apply it. And that's one of the slipperiest questions in the law of contract and tort. And there's nothing about making it a constitutional principle that makes it any easier.
My question is directed to Mr. Abrams in particular and to anyone else that would care to respond to it. And it pertains to libel law. In the era of the Star Chamber, that court held to the view that the greater the truth, the greater the libel. And in the wake of New York Times against Sullivan and its abrogation of the ability of states to award damages, at least as for libel, at least as it pertains to public figures, it seems to me that the court has sort of turned that view on its head, and the rule is now the less the truth, the less the libel. And the reason being is that we simply append the rubric of opinion to whatever is said. And my question to you is in view of the prior history of libel law in the states as it applied to public figures, what is it in the First Amendment that justifies that result? Why does the First Amendment say anything about this question?
It has to.
Well, when the First Amendment says Congress shall pass no law abridging the freedom of speech or of the press, there's no doubt in my mind that at the time it was passed, and at the time, if you'll forgive the expression, the 14th Amendment was passed, libel, whatever libel was considered not protected by the First Amendment. The question is, at least in terms of developing First Amendment doctrine, how to square that proposition with the sort of freedom of speech and of the press, which in a wide range of other areas were being held the right of all citizens. Now, the case arose, as you know, New York Times against Sullivan. Where did the court find the protection, the actual malice protection in Sullivan? Well, in part it looked to a case in Kansas, which had held that was the law of Kansas. More broadly, I think, it looked, as it said, to American history. It looked to a notion of original understanding. It looked to the rejection, at least by the beginning of the early 19th century, of the notion of seditious libel. It found elements of seditious libel in a prosecution by a government official of a newspaper for what it said about him, and it fashioned fashioned a balancing test for libel in order to assure free speaking, forthright, robust, uninhibited debate. I think one can argue, and members of the court are now, about how to fashion that. It seems to me that it is certainly well within our First Amendment tradition, and well within the history, not just of the First Amendment, but of the country from the time that we started, to say that there was needed, not just in 1964, but today, and that the First Amendment supports the proposition that we should have today very considerable protection to attack the officials who lead us. That was what New York Times versus Sullivan, I think, was about. A final note, I really don't believe it is an accurate statement to say that the way out the courts have found is to say that everything is opinion. The yes. courts have, Justice Powell said in a language quoted by Judge Easterbrook, who was then denounced today for using it, the courts have said, the Supreme Court has said, there's no such thing as a false opinion. While that is an important element of First Amendment law, and in my view, one which should commend itself to every libertarian in the audience, that is not the hardcore part of New York Times against Sullivan, which has made that case so dramatic in its impact on libel law. That's the Sullivan findings, I think. The Sullivan conclusions, which are so important, are A, the reversal of the burden of proof, that in public official cases, public figure cases, the party suing has to prove by clear and convincing evidence, the party suing has to prove falsehood, maybe by clear and convincing evidence, and of course the actual malice requirement, which came from Sullivan itself.
If I can just throw in a sort of an additional question, as someone who has been criticized, and that you have to accept that as part of the business. But I don't agree that the way the laws are now written that they promote freedom of speech and dialogue. I think they really can inhibit it. If there's no way to speak back as an official or as a private citizen who is a public official for purposes of the private act, it's sometimes I find it very, very difficult to speak back when the publication won't publish your letter or whatever. You have no forum, and I don't know what the solution is, but I do sometimes wonder if it isn't a license for the big media to. To be sloppy with no response back.
Yeah, I must say just one thing. I agree that the question of libel, seditious or otherwise, is probably a First Amendment issue. It seemed to me that Floyd Abrams is on right grounds when he says, well, let's reverse the burden of proof. That's consistent with the idea of defamation being misrepresentation, and normally the elements of a prima facie case should fall on the plaintiff. The much more controversial element is actual malice, and his explanation of how they came in is they sort of just grabbed it. And it's a deviation from every standard of tort rule with respect to invasion of interest, which would typically hover between negligence and strict liability. And it seems to me that the great travesty, mistake of New York Times, is that it does not permit somebody to get a declaration from a court that a statement was false. And it seems to me that even if one is going to be very reluctant about the award of damages, if a defendant libels a plaintiff, a declaration that was mistaken is important. And I think the Sharon case with its busted procedure showed the power of the declaration even when damages were denied.
I really don't think it's accurate to say that the New York Times case forecloses that. Rules of federal jurisdiction may do it.
Oh, I don't believe that.
But if there
That's
were
really simple.
I know. But if there were but if there were a statute which established a right to seek a declaration without seeking damages, that would raise very serious issues. That is to say, that might well be constitutional. In any event, New York Times versus Sullivan on its face does not foreclose that. New York Times versus Sullivan says nothing about seeking declarations. No one has ever sought to get a declaration. No court has ever held it unconstitutional to obtain a declaration. So I think you're wrong.
But which way do you think the clear implication of that decision is? It seems to me that one of the reasons nobody's passed the statute is that the sense that they have is the actual malice requirement is comprehensive with respect to all elements of the case. And I put it to you that even though nobody's done it, that statute should be regarded as constitutional. And the question I'm asking you is, do you agree?
Now, for the first time today, I have client interests which come to mind.
Yes.
Do I agree? Let me say that I think it probably would be held to be constitutional. My sense is that I think the court would say that if you took the risk of damages out completely of the libel law, that you could do away with actual malice. I have personally, for example, flirted with supporting, at least on a state level, Representative Schumer's proposal, which he'd introduced before Congress, which would allow public officials to seek declaratory judgments vindicating their reputation without seeking damages, and would
allow the media or whoever, defendants, if they chose and they were sued for damage by a public official, to transform that into an action for a declaratory judgment against them. So I think at least a very strong argument can be made that if there is no risk of damages at all in a libel suit, that a statute which so provided would be constitutional.
I suppose my question is directed to Professor Epstein, and it's a follow-up question to what Judge Scalia spoke about earlier. That's that you talk about moving away from original intent jurisprudence and grounding our judicial decisions in a strict and rigorous analysis of the Constitution, using the interpretive categories of Locke and, I imagine, Hume. My question to you is, how does that sort of grounding avoid degenerating into strict, well, a rigorous interpretation of the Constitution using the categories of other people, say Marx or Heidegger?
Well, the Marxist Constitution will read, nor shall private property be permitted in this society, which is a different constitution from which says, nor shall private property be taken without public use. The Marxist Constitution says, no speech shall be permitted unless expressly authorized by the government, which shall have a sole monopoly over all forms of media communication. I think that those are rather different amendments from the ones that we have, and they ought to be construed in a rather different way. And if I were a judge in a Marxist society, which I would not be, it seems to me that when the New York Times started to speak, I would lock them up and garrote them. And the point is that words do have some sense, and one of the things that I despaired about many of the presentations yesterday and this morning is the theory that somehow or other, when you talk about original intention or concepts like freedom, in 200 years they lose all their meaning, whereas in philosophical traditions they've managed to survive for thousands of years. And I'm much more a naive believer in fixed and determinate meanings of even difficult political concepts if you're prepared to work them through. And I don't think there's anything which is short of hard work which will get us there.
I think I'm going to have to call it quits now. I hate to do this to you, but we are running 25 minutes late. Lunch is waiting, and I want to thank the panel again.